Good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. Today is Sunday, January 18th, 2026. My name is Leah M., recovered compulsive overeater, and your moderator for today. The share ID numbers for Friday, January 16th are the following. For the 7 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 23,133. That's 23133. And for the 10 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 23,134. That's 23134. This morning, A Vision for You presents Step 2, How We Came to Believe. Step 2. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. We are driven into Overeaters Anonymous by the frustration, bewilderment, terror, pain, and despair we experience in the bondage of compulsive overeating. Finally, cornered by our disease, we stand at the jumping off place. In step one, we admitted our powerlessness over our addiction and the unmanageability of our lives. If, however, we were powerless over our problem, how could we ever solve it? In step two, we are given the solution. Our solution is not hopeless, far from it. There is hope, but that hope lies outside ourselves. As the Big Book says, we had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves. But where and how were we to find this power? In step two, we begin that search, an undertaking that will lead us through the remainder of the 12 steps. The beauty of the second step is that the restoration to sanity, which the step asks us to believe is possible, has already begun. By admitting our powerlessness in the first step and accepting that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity in the second, we have already begun the journey that will lead us to the spiritual awakening and to a restoration to sanity. As the Big Book says, we needed to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? As soon as a person can answer, yes, I do, we emphatically assure that person that he or she is on the way. Joining us today to elaborate on step two is Janet D., a recovered compulsive overeater from North Carolina. Janet is a loyal servant of Overeaters Anonymous and a beloved member of A Vision for You. And it's with great delight and appreciation that I welcome Janet B. to the line this morning. Good morning, Janet.
Good morning, Leah. Good morning, everyone. This is Janet B., recovered compulsive eater in North Carolina. And I'd just like to start with a quick prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you so much for this book and for these 12 and for its recipe for a miracle included in it. And just please guide my words today. Amen. So really happy to be with you all this morning. I'm going to go through the chapter, We Agnostics, touching a little bit on other things here and there. But I would like to start on the bottom of page 43, the very last paragraph. This is the paragraph where they went in depth on what it means to be powerless, unable to stop. And they just close it by saying, once more, the alcoholic, or for us, the compulsive eater, at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink, the first bite. Well, what does that mean? It means I can't think my way out of it. That I, who have a terrible cat allergy, who can remember every time someone invites me to her house and she has a cat, that I cannot go near it, because if I go near a cat, liable to have an asthma attack, get a sinus infection, eyes get all red, you know, all snotty and disgusting. I remember that. When it came to food, that same mechanism that allowed me to remember didn't work. I would say, this time I can have one and I'll be able to stop. Even though 100 times before I said the same thing and couldn't stop. So the defense that kept me from getting an asthma attack from a cat didn't work when it came from food. Okay, so what do I do if I don't have a mental defense and I can't think my way out of it? Well, it says, except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. So they're telling me the group can't be my higher power, because y'all might love me, you might care about me, you might give me great knowledge, but you can't give me power. And then they say his defense must come from a higher power, capital H, capital P. So we can turn the page and see how we can access this power. And they start off page 44 by saying, in the preceding chapters, you've learned something of alcoholism, something of compulsive eating. What have we learned, right? That we can't think our way out of it. And then they tell us how to know if we're a real addict, if when you honestly want to, you can't stop, or if when you start, you can't control the amount you take, you're probably an alcoholic, a compulsive eater. So wanting to stop but being unable to defines an addict. You know, so many times I've talked to people and they say, well, I must not want. Okay. So I've talked to people and they said, I want to stop, but I'm still in the food, so I must not really want to stop. And I'm like, no, you're just addicted. You want to stop, but you're unable to. But if you're willing to do the work, you'll get the power so that you can. And then they tell us what our solution is. They say, if that be the case, if you're a real compulsive eater, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Well, a couple questions here. Like, first, what is a spiritual experience? And then, why do I need it? Why do we need it? Because at its roots, this is a spiritual malady, right? We all know in chapter 5, it says, once the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. So if it's a spiritual problem, it needs a spiritual solution. And they define it on page 25, a spiritual experience, one of the most beautiful paragraphs in the book. The great fact is just this and nothing less. So y'all, we should settle for nothing less than this, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences. And now they're going to tell us what a spiritual experience is and does. It has revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and towards God's universe. So it changes the way we think about life in general, toward other people, toward God and the world. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. So they're telling me God is going to do a miracle in my heart and in my life. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. Well, what's the first thing that I can't do by myself? I couldn't stop my compulsive eating. I was a hardcore compulsive eater. I stole people's food. And then I'd go out to get a replacement, and I would eat the replacement before I could get it back. I stole people's money for food. I was just, all I did was want what I wanted, and I didn't care about anyone else. I certainly didn't care about God, about his universe, about other people. I just cared about myself. And I thought all I needed was a magic food plan to get better. But I came in and y'all told me, no, what I needed was a spiritual experience. And then back on page 44, they say to a agnostic, such an experience seems impossible. I love how they say that to one who feels he's an atheist or agnostic. It's like they're saying, You may think you're an atheist or agnostic. You may feel you are, but you're really not. I mean, like, this is America. I could say, I have no lungs. I'm a lung agnostic, but clearly I have lungs. So they say, okay, you may think you're an atheist or agnostic, but if you've taken a real first step, you have two choices: to be doomed to a compulsive eating death or to live on a spiritual basis of life. And they continue on and they say, we had to face the fact we must find a spiritual basis of life, which is really trusting God, cleaning up the wreckage of our past, and helping others. And they say, if you think you're an atheist or agnostic, you may be disconcerted. You may be sad, but cheer up. And then they tell us some things that don't work. They say, if a mere code of morals, a better philosophy of life, those things don't work. If I just tried to be a nicer person, or I had this like philosophy that told me how important it was to be nice, says that doesn't work for us. Why? Page 45 says these codes and philosophies did not save us. We needed to be rescued, right? If I'm in quicksand, a code of morals or a philosophy of about how quicksand is bad, and if you get in it, you will be sucked under, that's not going to do anything. I needed to be rescued. And they tell us, I wish to be moral. I wish to be philosophically comforted, but the needed power wasn't there. My human resources failed. And then the next paragraph, they define what the issue is. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. Not lack of desire, right? I had a strong desire to stop binging. I wanted to stop binging more than anything in the world. My binging and my bulimia was so horrific that I ended up needing major surgery on my esophagus. I had a desire, but they're telling me lack of desire wasn't my problem, nor was lack of a good moral code, nor was lack of a good food plan, nor lack of access to meetings. Lack of power, that was my dilemma. I went to meetings for 6.5 years. I went almost daily sometimes, and it didn't do it because my problem wasn't lack of information. It was lack of power. They said we had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously, right? But where and how are we to find this power? And they tell us, well, that's what this book is about. And then they give us what I think is the mission statement of this book. And if we're going to look for clues about God, we can start right here. That's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. Well, that tells me four things about this power. If this power is going to solve my problem, it must be able to think, to reason, right? Like, hurricane is certainly a power greater than me, but a hurricane can't think and figure out how to solve my problem. Second, this power must be smart. I have 2 master's degrees and I couldn't think my way out of this. So this power has to be pretty smart. Number 3, this power has to be strong because this illness is stronger than I am. So this power has to be stronger than me and stronger than the illness. It's like I have 1 unit of power, and this illness of compulsive eating has 100 units of power. So this power greater than me has to have at least 101 units of power. Fortunately, he has infinite power. And most important, this power must care about me. Otherwise, why would this power bother trying to solve my problem? And then actually solving it, this power must care about me. So has a consciousness, smart, strong, and cares about me. Okay, that's a God I could be interested in. I grew up always believing in God, raised to believe in God, but my belief in God was that he had this like big ledger up in the skies, and on one side of the page, he wrote down everything I did right, and on the other side, he wrote down everything I did wrong, which of course was a longer list. So because of that, 5 seconds after I died, I thought he was going to meet me with a baseball bat. But this tells me something different, that God cares about me. And then they say, we've written a book that's spiritual as well as moral, and it means we are going to talk about And they say, we know it's difficult. A lot of times a person's really happy when they learn about what their problem is. They learn about this fellowship. But his face falls when we speak of spiritual matters, especially when we mention God. But again, think about the God this big book is introducing us to, as a consciousness, smart, strong, and cares about me, loves me. And I think what blocks us is we have a lot of prejudices and spiritual cataracts. So the next paragraph, last paragraph on page 45, really addresses these prejudices. It says, we know how this person has felt. We have shared his honest doubt and prejudice, like doubt, does God even exist? Prejudice, preconceived notions. Prejudice doesn't just mean I don't like people of a certain race or religion. It's a preconceived idea that blocks me from caring about someone else, and here, that blocks me from caring about God. And there's four prejudices in this paragraph, and then there's a fifth later on. So they talk about to others, some of us have been violently anti-religious. To others, the word God brought up a particular idea of him with which someone had tried to impress them during childhood. That's the first prejudice, a concept that we were given as kids or that was modeled to us. It doesn't work for us. Thankfully, this book allows us to have our own conception of God. So that meant I could get rid of the God with the baseball bat in favor of a God who really loved me and wasn't keeping track of what I did right and what I did wrong and would withdraw his affections if I didn't do enough right. I could get rid of that concept. They say, we were bothered with the fact, page 46, with the thought that faith and dependence upon a power beyond ourselves was somewhat weak, even cowardly. That's the second prejudice. Believing in God makes me weak. Well, you know what? I mean, I put electricity on in my house. I don't sit and feel, boy, if I can't see in the dark, that makes me weak. So therefore, I'm not going to use electricity. I was weak. I couldn't solve this problem on my own. I needed God. I still need God for lots of things. My son is going on he's in the military. He's going on a deployment to the Middle East sometime later this year. I need the power of God so that I can still live a functioning, productive life and not be consumed by fear. Doesn't make me weak. And then it says, continues on page 46, we looked upon this world of warring individuals, warring theological systems, and inexplicable calamity with deep skepticism. Well, I think that's our third prejudice, that if there was a God, he wouldn't allow such bad things to happen. And isn't that the prejudice that Bill Wilson had, right? If we go back to page 11, he says, judging from what I've seen in Europe and since, the power of God in human affairs seemed negligible, right? He said, the burning, the chicanery, the religious dispute made me sick. If there was a devil, he seemed the boss universal, right? It's like bad things happen. It's true. Bad things happen to all of us. We see it happening around us. I look at human trafficking and I say, God, how could you not stop this? But what did Ebby do when Bill said that? He didn't sit there and have this deep theological discussion. He just said, all I know is that when I surrendered my life to God, he took away the obsession to drink. And you know, y'all, I can't explain why God allows human trafficking, but I can tell you that when I surrendered my life to God and I try to do what he wants, I don't have the obsession with food, and I can live a productive, happy life. Maybe this side of heaven, I will never know why God allows human trafficking, and I am okay now with not knowing. Okay, the fourth prejudice, it says, who could comprehend a supreme being anyhow? That's really, I can't believe in something I don't understand. Well, again, I go back to electricity. I do not understand. I understand there's poles outside my house that carry electricity through wires and they're in my lamp now. But like, how does that electricity get to those poles? I have no idea. But I'm not going to be foolish enough to say, well, you know what, until I understand how it all works, I'm going to sit in the dark. And the fifth prejudice, I think, is found in chapter 5, where it says, the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot. So the fifth prejudice, I think, is, if I believe in God, I can't do what I want. For me, that didn't serve me very well. So just real quickly, the five prejudices, the concepts we were given to us as children or modeled were wrong or didn't work for us. Two, belief in God makes me weak. Three, I can't believe in God because the universe is so poorly run. Four, I can't believe in somebody or something I can't understand. And five, if I can't believe in God, if I believe in God, I can't do what I want. So the next paragraph on page 46, they say, yeah, we've had all these thoughts and experiences, but we're going to reassure you. We found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice, so what I always have my sponsees do at this point is look at all their prejudices and then work through them. Just because a thought comes into my head, I don't have to accept it as truth. So really work through this. Because it tells us as soon as we're able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we get results. Even though it's impossible to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God. So a couple things. I once looked in the book to see where we start getting power, right? Because lack of power is our dilemma. First step doesn't give me power. All it does is gives me the willingness to do this work. But here, I start getting results. And the next paragraph will tell me what these results are. And here, at this point, they're telling me a willing to believe in this power, which is God. Again, God is anyone comprehends him. I may have a different religious view than the next person, and the next person may not have any religious view at all, but just a concept of God, and that's fine. Later in the book, it says, provided it makes sense. I think we can all agree that a doorknob does not make sense. A doorknob cannot infuse me with power. So they say at this point, if we have a willingness to believe, we get results. Okay, how does it work to just have a willingness to believe? And I think it can go something like this. We can say an honest prayer because we never want to go to God and lie. And we never want to go to God and say, I believe in you, if we really aren't sure. But I think we can say a prayer like this. I don't know if you exist. And if you do exist, I don't know if you care about me. But if you do exist and you do care, I need some help. My personal belief is that God can't resist a prayer like that. As long as we do what they talk about, putting spiritual principles into practice right away. So right away, even if I'm not sure, I can start being honest, right? I can stop telling lies. I can start putting the welfare of others ahead of myself. I can start doing self-sacrifice, means giving up something I want in order to help another person. I can start doing that even if I'm not sure. And I think that combination, a prayer of willingness and a beginning to put spiritual practices into practice, is irresistible to God. And they go ahead in the next paragraph and they state, we don't have to consider another's conception of God, our own conception, however inadequate, because we're going to keep learning and growing about God. What we know about God today should be less than what we know about him tomorrow, next week, next year. But they say, however inadequate, it's enough to make the approach, right, with that honest prayer and effect a contact with him. Y'all, we're not just going to believe in God. We are going to have a relationship with God. It says, as soon as we admitted the possible existence of, and look at some of these beautiful names for God, creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed of a new sense of power and direction, provided we took other simple steps. Those are the results we get as soon as we're willing. We get power, power over the food, right? Like the obsession starts going away. And I have seen that over and over. Once a person gets to this point, I'll say, how's the food obsession? She's like, oh, you know what? I'm not really obsessing about food. It's like unbelievable. And direction, as in what we do next, provided we took other simple steps. So we can't just hang out in this part of step two saying, okay, I'm willing to believe in God. We have to move on. Belief will need to be followed up with surrender. But then they just comfort us. They say, God doesn't make hard terms with people who seek him. The realm of spirit is broad, roomy, and all-inclusive to those who earnestly seek, open to everyone. On page 47, they say, when we speak of God, we mean your own conception of God. Don't let prejudices you may have against spiritual terms deter you from asking yourself what they mean to you. We can start where we are. And they say, we needed to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? Willing, like accepted by choice. Right. And again, they say, as soon as a man says he believes or is willing, he is on his way. The next paragraph, again, they tell us we can start making use of spiritual principles right away. We can do what we know. On top of page 48, they tell us more prejudices, more things that can block us from God, that we're handicapped by obstinacy, which is a stubborn refusal to change one's opinion, by sensitiveness. It's like people don't want to talk to us about difficult things because, you know, it's like they have to walk on eggshells because we're just so sensitive, and unreasoning prejudice. And they say, okay, this kind of thinking has to be abandoned. And they say, you know, we may resist, but ultimately it's not difficult when we're faced with door number one, alcoholic destruction or compulsive eating destruction. Door number two, become open-minded on spiritual matters. There's no door number three, which is God waving a magic wand to remove our obsession without doing these 12 steps. I mean, I guess he could, but that's not the program he designed. Or there's no door number four, take a magic food plan and that'll work. And they say, really, it's not our job to convince people they need to believe in God. Alcohol or food was the great persuader. It beat us into a state of reasonableness. So if someone keeps having trouble with step two, I might suspect that they have trouble with step one, that they haven't really admitted they're powerless and that their life is unmanageable. And then they go ahead and talk about that prosaic steel girder, which basically to me means I don't understand certain things, but I can still make use of them. I don't understand electricity, but I still turn on the switch and I just trust that the power will be there. On page 49, they tell us how we should regard ourselves. They say, instead of regarding ourselves as intelligent agents, spearheads of God's ever-advancing creation, we agnostics and atheists chose to believe our human intelligence was the last word. Okay, they're telling me I'm supposed to see myself as an intelligent agent. Like, right? Our book tells us God gave us brains to use. So that means, like, I can ask questions. I'm an agent. Well, when we surrender our lives to God, it tells us how we think of him. He is the principal. We are the agents. So the principal has work that he asked the agent to help carry out. Well, what's God's work? God's ever advancing creation. He wants me to be an agent of his ever advancing creation. And I was thinking about that, like, well, didn't God just create the world in 6 days and then he took a day off? Well, he's still advancing his creation. What's he creating now? He's creating new people. He's recreating our lives. Doctor's opinion, Roman numeral 28, recreating lives. That's what he's doing. So So I get to be an agent, an intelligent agent, part of God's search and rescue missions for other compulsive eaters like me. And by the way, it does not make me any better than any compulsive eater who hasn't recovered yet. All it means is I got on the bus one stop ahead of the next guy. Doesn't make me one bit better. And they continue on and they say, we beg you to lay aside your prejudice, even against organized religion. And it gives us another prejudice we have. We used to amuse ourselves by cynically dissecting spiritual beliefs and practices. That means I've taken a position to be bitterly and sneeringly distrustful. And they say, no, we stopped doing that. So that's an action I can take. I can stop being cynical. I can stop dissecting other people's beliefs. And what I'm supposed to observe is that spiritually minded people of all races, colors, and creeds are demonstrating a degree of stability, happiness, and usefulness. And that's what I'm seeking and looking at. I want to be stable, I want to be happy, and I want to be useful. That's what our relationship with God should and does give us. Age 50, they tell us another block we get, and that's looking at people's shortcomings and using it as a basis of wholesale condemnation. So I remember when my kids were in college, driving to see one of them once, and I was cut off by this car, pretty nasty, aggressive driver. And I looked at the license plate, and it was a state where I didn't think I knew anyone. So I'm like, oh, people from the state are just, you know, jerks. That was my initial reaction. It's like, Janet, wait, this is one person. And then I remembered a woman I knew in OA who was from that same state, and she was lovely. So that was helpful. But it just helped me see how quickly I can fall into wholesale condemnation, right? We are people who have black and white thinking. And sometimes it's okay for me to live in the gray. And they go ahead and they talk about the stories in the big book. And they really tell us what the purpose of telling our stories is. Each teller, you will find a wide variation in the way each teller approaches and conceives of the power which is greater than himself. That's the point of us telling our stories. How did we get our relationship with God? They say, okay, people have different ways they found God, but on one thing, these men and women are strikingly agreed. Imagine getting like two alcoholics to agree strikingly on anyone. Here they're saying 100 of them agreed. And what did they agree on? They all believe in a power greater than themselves. And not only that, they've gained access to this power. And third, this power has in each case, 100% of the time, accomplished the miraculous. So you all, at its essence, this program is about miracles. And they say, these were thousands of people, worldly indeed, these were smart people, and they've declared that since they've come to believe in a power greater than themselves, so have faith, take certain actions toward that power, surrender, and do certain simple things, I believe clear away the wreckage of the past, there's been a revolutionary change in their way of living and thinking. And this is such an enticement in the face of collapse and despair. So if that's despair, total failure of human resources, what did they all get? They found a new power, peace, happiness, and sense of direction flowed into them like an infusion, right? An IV filled with power, peace, happiness, and direction. And this happened soon. I love that word, soon, not like 10 years later, soon after they wholeheartedly met a few simple requirements. And page 51, what a beautiful promise. They say, leaving aside the drink question, they say, so even if we were abstinent, life still would have been unsatisfactory until the consciousness of the presence of God came. And now that is the most important fact of their lives. you know, when I was trying to get abstinent, and I spent 6.5 years in OA before anybody really told me about the 12 steps and about how having a relationship with God was so important and living an honorable way of life, clearing up the wreckage of my past and then continuing to clear away the wreckage of each day, praying and meditating to know God's will and helping others. Before that, I thought abstinence was the most important fact of my life. And I used to write, abstinence from compulsive overeating is the most important thing in my life, over and over again, you know, in my notebook. And I have found that if I make God the most important thing in my life, the abstinence happens automatically. And they continue on and they tell us more things that block us. We're fettered, like shackled, by superstition, tradition, and all sorts of fixed ideas, and that we are biased and prejudiced and unreasonable about the realm of the spirit. And on page 52, they say, we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view, right? In the book, they give the example of exploring the moon by means of a rocket. Well, obviously that has happened. So I guess now it would be electric cars, but now that has happened. And so cars that drive themselves, okay, gosh, it's crazy and I don't understand it, but it seems that like that's happening. And they say, okay, we're so willing to discard and adapt our ideas about things in the physical world. Shouldn't we try to do this with things in the spiritual world as well? And they go on bottom of 52. They say, we saw others solve their problems by a simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe. How does that work? How can I simply rely on God, right? A beautiful name for him, spirit of the universe. How can I do that? It means I do what I think is right and I leave the results up to him. So I think, again, now about my son getting a what could be, you know, a fairly dangerous deployment. And I just trust that the God who, you know, gave me my son, who brought my son up, who, you know, loves my son, will take care of my son. And then I do not have to live in fear. And they tell us our ideas don't work, but the God idea did. And then they talk about the Wright brothers. And they say the Wright brothers' almost childish faith that they could build a machine which would fly was the mainspring of their accomplishment. Without that, nothing could have happened. Okay, if I were like given a quiz on like what was the mainspring of the Wright brothers' accomplishment that allowed them to build an airplane, I would have said their knowledge of, I don't know, aerodynamics and gravity and physics and all that stuff. And they're telling me, no, it was their faith that they could do it. And without that, nothing could have happened. Okay, that doesn't really make sense at face value. Until we think about really the wording of step two, such an odd step, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Different than the other steps. In the other step, we admit, we make amends, we, you know, write a fourth step. But on this one, I have to believe. Well, if I had pneumonia, I don't need to believe that penicillin can restore me to health. If, you know, someone just like, I don't know, sticks liquid penicillin in my water and I drink it, I'll get better. But we are required to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And step three says, we turn our will and our lives over to this power, to God as we understand him. How come I have to believe that? Because what they talk about here, faith is the currency in the spiritual world. Faith actually gets something done. In the physical world, if I want like a tank of gas or, you know, a bag of groceries, I go to the clerk and I hand them money or my credit card because that's how things are done in the physical world. But I cannot hand God my American Express card and say, you know, okay, here's my credit card, restore me to sanity. The Wright brothers' almost childish faith was the mainspring of their accomplishments. Me believing that God could restore me to sanity actually is essential for God restoring me to sanity, because faith does something in the spiritual world. It's a catalyst in the spiritual world. On page 53, they talk about logic and they say, it's great, but it only gets us so far. At some point, we get to a part, says, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, we could not postpone or evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or else he is nothing. Well, what does that mean, either God is everything? Does that mean that, like, God is my pen and God is my cell phone? No, that's just, like, a little silly. What they mean, I believe, is that either I give God everything or it's if I give him nothing. I can't say, God, take my food plan, but I'll cheat on my taxes. Or, God, you know, take away my obsession with food, but don't take away my, you know, padding my expense account at work. I either give God everything or I give nothing. And then the bottom of page 53, they say, come on, we all really have faith. Page 54, we have faith in our own ability to think. So we've been faithful to the God of reason. And, oh, by the way, you don't just have faith, you worship. I'm thinking, what? And they're saying, yeah, we've variously worshiped people, sentiment, things, money, and ourselves. Right, worshiped other people. I mean, come on, we all did that when we were in middle school. We had a crush on that boy or girl, and we thought, you know, we would just die if the person didn't love us back. Sentiment, things. Have we ever worshiped our new car, our beautiful clothes, money, and ourselves? Notice what's missing from this list, alcohol. It doesn't say we worshiped alcohol or for us food. Sometimes people say food was my God, and I don't think that's true. I think when we worship ourselves, worship other things that aren't God, the food comes in by default. None of us sit there and really worship food. We all wish we didn't have to think about food so much. Food is not the idol. Self is the idol, and then food has access to us. And on page 55, I'm one of the most beautiful, well, actually, back up, top of page 55, it says, we've seen another kind of flight. So they were talking about the Wright brothers, who their childish faith allowed them to build the airplane. They say, and here's another kind of flight, spiritual liberation from this world, people who rose above their problems. And these people who were able to rise above their problems said, God made these things possible. And we only smiled. We saw spiritual relief, but we like to tell ourselves it wasn't true. Why on earth would I do that? Why would I see people who recovered and they said, God removed their food obsession, and just sit there and smile and say, yeah, right. I think for me, I have a lot of pride, and a lot of times I would rather be right than be healed. I would rather be right than be healed. And I have to, you know, make sure that my pride doesn't get in the way of my healing. We can start to believe by examining, like, okay, God's doing it for others. Maybe he could do it for me. And then what I think is the most beautiful line in the big book, actually, we were fooling ourselves. For deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. That's so beautiful. That tells me when God created me, he gave me two lungs, two kidneys, one stomach, one heart, and somewhere in there, he planted the fundamental idea of himself, that God loves me, God loves us so much that he plants the fundamental idea of himself within us. And then they tell us, okay, but this idea of God can be obscured. It's like cataracts obscure a person from seeing in the physical world. Well, here's some spiritual cataracts that can obscure us from seeing God. Calamity, pomp, and worship of other things. Calamity, that's like bad things that have happened to me or those I care about, the things that make me say, well, you know, if there was a God, he wouldn't allow fill in the blank. War, poverty, starving children, my children not to listen to me, right? Anything we consider calamity. I pop, worship of myself. Well, if God doesn't give me everything I want 5 seconds after I ask for it, then he's of no use to me. Well, isn't that treating God like a genie? Like, God, I want this, that, and the other. Thank you, goodbye. That didn't work, right? And worship of other things, right? People, sentiment, things, money, worship of other things. But they say, okay, we may have those spiritual cataracts, but in some form or other, it is there. This worship of God, this belief in God is there. That faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in our lives are facts as old as man himself. So faith and miraculous demonstrations. What good are miraculous is faith without power if I don't have a miraculous demonstration of his power? I believed in God my entire life. Faith, but I didn't have a miraculous because I didn't have surrender. It was like I believed in God, but I treated him as my cosmic. And so while we're talking about the spiritual cataracts, I think on page 60, there's a few more that are worth mentioning. It tells us that before we continue on step 3, so while we're still at step 2, there's 3 pertinent ideas we have to believe. First, that we're compulsive eaters and can't manage our own lives. That was pretty easy. 2, that probably no human power could have relieved our compulsive eating. Well, pretty easy also. And then C, that God could and would if he were sought. And that one is not so easy. So I found it helpful to break it down. So I would start by asking someone, do you believe that God exists? And after doing a bunch of work on step 2, people generally say, yes, I believe that God exists. If not, you need to go back and do some more work on step 2. Do you believe that God has restored other people to sanity? And we look around and we see, you know, a bunch of our friends in OA and we say, yes. God has restored other people to sanity. Great. Do you believe God could restore you to sanity if he wanted to? And then people generally say, well, yes, he's God. He could if he wanted to. And then the next part, and here's where people get stuck a lot. Do you believe he will restore you to sanity if you seek him? And this is where often people say, no, I believe he exists. I believe he's restored other people to sanity. I believe he could restore me to sanity if he wanted to, but I don't believe he will. Don't believe he wants to. And I've thought about it, and I've thought there's 5 reasons why people think God won't restore them personally to sanity. 1, I've done some really bad things. 2, it's a little different than this. Not I've done bad things, but just I am bad. I don't deserve it. It's like shame. 3, well, I caused this illness, so I can't ask God for help. 4, I've tried so many times before and it hasn't worked. And 5, I'm not willing to do the work to seek him. So let me address those all. For the first person who says, I've done some really bad things, I would say you're in great company. So did the founders of this program. That's why there's a 9 step here. We get a chance to make amends. Doesn't block us. 2 is a little trickier. If someone says, I just don't deserve it. And I think for that, there's, I guess, 2 solutions. 1 is to, you know, spend like lots and lots of money and time in therapy to have a therapist convince us that we're worth it and have self-esteem. And the second is to realize that worthiness is never a requirement of God's. The first 164 pages, we will not find the word worthy. Worthiness is not a requirement. Only willingness is a requirement. We have to be willing. It doesn't matter. I certainly didn't deserve what God did for me. I went out and like pretended I was raped to get a boyfriend to pay attention to me. I stole people's food. Like I certainly did not deserve it. God doesn't care if we're worthy or not. We're his kids. He loves us. We're worthy just based on our relationship to him. number three, I caused it. So yeah, there's debates on like, did we cause this? Were we born with it? But let's say we did cause it, right? The book says selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of this illness. So let's say by being selfish and self-centeredness, I created an environment where this illness could thrive. Okay, I caused it. Does that mean I'm not going to go to God for help because I caused it? I mean, if I think about it, if I'm crossing the street and I'm looking at my cell phone and I get hit by a truck and both my legs are broken, would I ever say to the ambulance driver, don't take me to the hospital, to the orthopedic surgeon, because it's my fault I got hit by a truck. I caused this. Just leave me here in the street. Like, we would never do that. But when it comes to God, we sometimes get a little noble, like, well, this is my fault, so I can't go to him for help. We can. It's okay. Number four, I've tried this so many times before and it hasn't worked. Well, let's go back to my cell phone that's probably smashed because it got hit by a truck. And let's say I've tried to take pictures with it 100 times before. Now my son comes up to me and says, Mom, you're pushing the wrong button. Here's the right button. Suddenly, it doesn't matter whether it's my first time trying to take pictures or I've tried 100 times before and it hasn't worked. I'll be able to take pictures. Well, let's say he showed me the button a while back and I didn't use it because I just wasn't willing to do what anyone told me to do. Today, I can make a decision. I'm going to listen to someone who understands cell phones better than me, and I'll be able to take pictures. And the fifth reason people give is I'm not willing to seek. And to that person, I say, you know, you're probably right. You know, can't say that God will restore you to sanity because the requirements to work the steps, make a decision that you want what we have and all we have to offer is a spiritual experience and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. So if a person isn't willing to go to any length, you know, it's really saying, yeah, you really aren't guaranteed anything by working these steps. So these are the things that that block us. These are the things that can block us. And they continue on back on page 55, and they say, we saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feelings we had for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. So they were saying that God, it's a fact that he is there. They say we can only clear the ground a bit if our testimony helps sweep away prejudice. So again, we need to look at our prejudices, remembering that our concept of God can actually be the impediment to our relationship with God. We have to think honestly and search diligently. It says, then you can join us. And they close with a story about a man who thought he was an atheist. Again, they're saying he thought he was an atheist. Page 66 or 56, they're telling the story of the minister's son, whose full story is beautiful, starts on page 208, our southern friend. But on page 56, they say, okay, he was a rebel. He thought he got too much religion. There was trouble, frustration, business failure, insanity, fatal illness, suicide in his immediate family. And he was embittered, depressed, and disillusioned. So here was a guy just filled with resentment, disillusionment, depression, and he was in a hospital. And he's there with another alcoholic, and he says, if there is a God, he certainly hasn't done anything for me. And then on page 214, it recounts the discussion he had with his friend. 214, his friend says to him, he asks him, do you believe in a power greater than yourself? He said, I believe in electricity, but as for God, if there is one, he's never done anything for me. And his friend just asks him, are you willing to right all the wrongs you've ever done to anyone, no matter how wrong you thought the others were? Are you willing to be honest with yourself about yourself and tell someone about yourself? Are you willing to think about other people, of their needs instead of yours, in order to get rid of the drink problem? And he said, I'll do anything. So he had step one, he had willingness, but no step two yet. Then the man says, then all of your troubles are over. Our son, the minister's son, goes back to his room and he thinks, can all the worthwhile people I've known be wrong about God? So he's got like a step two. He's willing to believe. And his willingness, then what happens? All he is willing. Then a thought comes like a voice, page 215. Who are you to say there is no God? So, boy, really questioning his humility, right, his pride. He gets out of bed. He goes back to the other alcoholic's room, and he says, I must ask you a question. How does prayer fit into this thing? And this is what his friend says. Well, you've probably tried praying like I have. When you've been in a jam, you've said, God, please do this or that. And if it turned out your way, that was the last of it. And if it didn't, you said, there isn't any God, or he doesn't do anything for me. Is that right? The minister's son said, yes. And then listen to this. This is the way he tells him to pray. This isn't the way. The thing I do is to say, God, here I am, and here are all my troubles. I've made a mess of things and can't do anything about it. You take me and all my troubles and do anything you want with me. Does that answer your question? And the minister's son says, yes, it does. And this is what he did. He says, I return to bed. It doesn't make sense. Suddenly, I feel a wave of utter hopelessness sweep over me. I'm in the bottom of hell. And there, a tremendous hope is born. It might be true. But he had willingness. I tumble out of bed onto my knees. I know not what I say, but slowly a great peace comes to me. I feel lifted up. I believe in God. I crawl back into bed and sleep like a child. And if we go back to page 56, it elaborates on this experience he has. It says, he was overwhelmed by a conviction of the presence of God. So God met his willingness with such love and power. The barriers he had built through the years were swept away. He stood in the presence of infinite power and love. He had stepped from bridge to shore. For the first time, he lived in conscious companionship with his creator. What a wonderful way to live, right? How could I ever be like afraid or angry? Like, I'm in constant companionship with my creator. You know, the more I remember that, the less things in life ever bother me. So the minister's friends, they say, his cornerstone was fixed in place. No later vicissitude, no problem has ever shaken it. His alcoholic problem was taken away, right? Remember, we can't save ourselves. We need to be rescued. He was rescued. That disappeared. Save for a few brief moments of temptation, the thought of drink has never returned. And at such times, a great revulsion has risen up in him, right? He was able to recoil as from a hot flame. He could not drink even if he would. God had restored his sanity. And they say, what's this but a miracle of healing? That's the only way it can be described, a miracle of healing. Yet its elements are simple. I love that line. They're telling me the elements of a miracle are simple. Circumstances made him willing to believe, right? Circumstances, step one, willing to believe, step two. He humbly offered himself to his maker. Then he knew. He gave himself to God. Then he knew. And then they end with a promise. Even so has God restored all of us, 100% of us, to our right minds. The minister's son, the revelation was sudden. Some of us grow into it more slowly. I didn't have a lightning flash experience like that. It was just, oh, I'm abstinent in a day. And now it's 2 days. And now it's a week. And now it's a month. And now it's a year. And oh yeah, now when I get a resentment, I'm not angry for 3 days. I can resolve resentments more quickly. And I'm not so hypersensitive. Some of us, like me, grow into it more slowly. But here is the promise. has come to all who have honestly sought him. And I think this chapter gives us such a beautiful and helpful way to seek him. And it closes with a promise, and I'll close with this. When we drew near to him, he disclosed himself to us. And with that, I will pass.
Wow, Janet, thank you so much for this beautiful presentation this morning. So thorough, instructive, and inspiring. Another gem for our archives, that's for sure. The share ID for this presentation, 23,135. That's 23135 for Janet's presentation. Janet's contact information will be given at the conclusion of this recording, so do stay tuned for that. And we will now transition to a question and answer segment. You can pose a question to Janet, one question only, please, by pressing star 1 to unmute. I need your name as well as the first initial of your last name.
Joy MB, California.
Joy.
Tanya D.
Tanya. Great opportunity to go ahead. I'm sorry.
Jody E.
Jody E.
Janelle F.
Nancy L.
Nancy L.
Kathy K.
Kathy K. Star 1 to unmute if you'd like to get your name on the list. Okay, I have Joy MB, Tanya D, Jody E, Janelle F, Nancy L, Kathy K. Anyone else want to get on the list?
Am I muted?
Who's this? No, I'm hearing you. Okay. Let's begin our questions with Joy MP.
Good morning, fellow visioners. I am so grateful to be here this morning. Thank you so much for your presentation. The energy and time that you put into this is so evident. I'm Joy B from California, a compulsive overeater. My question is, do you not sometimes wonder or think, I found with myself, the fact that I had been steeped in religion all my life is a hindrance to my conceptualizing higher power, the way this book and this lifestyle is meant to conceptualize it?
I mean, so I think what you're asking is religion a hindrance? And I guess I would say sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. The book is really clear that it has principles that are compatible with most religions. And so now I consider myself a religious person. I go to church. I follow the practices of my religion. But there are people who have no religion at all and still have some beautiful recovery. So I think it depends on the individual. I don't think it was religion that blocked my view of God. It was just my conception of God. And I really was just using God. I wasn't surrendered to him. I was just using him. And I think that was the biggest problem of all.
Thank you, Joy MB, for your question. Next, Tanya D.
This is Tanya D., recovered compulsive overeater in Illinois. Thank you so much for that share, Janet. That was a really clear exposition of the chapter, and I'm going to give it to my sponsees to listen to as well. My question is, I often find that there are more worthwhile things that I could do than fit into a day. And so how do you connect with your higher power? How do you seek God's will around, you know, which worthwhile things to do and which worthwhile things not to do? That's my question.
So I think that's where step 11 comes in, right? Every morning I pray and meditate. And when I meditate, I specifically ask two things. I say, I pray for knowledge of your will for me and the power to carry it out. And how can I help the still suffering compulsive eater today? And if I have a specific question, like should I do A or B, I will ask that also. And sometimes I'll get an answer and sometimes I won't. And if I don't, I just go with my best instinct, right? Allowing that I might make a mistake. And that's how I would handle it.
Thank you very much, Tanya D. Jody E., your turn.
Thank you. Good morning. This is Jody E. from California, recovered compulsive overeater. Thank you so much, Janet. You said that it was easy to admit powerlessness. Well, not always for all people. So I'm wondering what you would say to a sponsee who is still having trouble admitting powerlessness over their disease and unwillingness to say that they're powerless.
Okay, so I think there are two different things, like being unwilling to or unable to. So if they're having trouble, here's how I would handle it. I would really explain. Is. I would just make sure that as her sponsor, I've given her a good understanding of what powerlessness is. And like for myself, I have a one-page sheet that I wrote up that I give to my sponsees that, you know, I talked about the mechanism that works that to keep me away from cats, didn't work when it came to food. And I'll give her that and I'll ask her to write examples of how her bridge works, like how she can remember if she goes near cats, if she goes near a hot stove, whatever her things are. And very specific examples with food on how she couldn't remember enough to stop her. I would have, and I would go through chapters 2 and 3 with her. And if after all that, she's like, you know what, I don't think I'm powerless, I don't think I'd be able to move ahead with her because that's a requirement. And I think it's a requirement because if someone doesn't admit they're powerless, then when the going gets hard, they get gone. They don't stick around. So I would just, as a sponsor, really put in the time with her to help her get it. And I hope that helps.
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Thank you, Jody. Janelle F., your turn.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't think I was heard. I thought my microphone was muting me. Can I be heard? I'm Janelle S. from
yes.
Laramie, Wyoming.
Yes.
Hi. Just something, I love the list of just not being able, why I couldn't be able to connect to my higher power. There is something that still blocks me. I feel unworthy. I feel shame and guilt over my mistakes, you know, and I have a form of religion that I can go to that says my higher power loves me unconditionally, is always willing to accept me. And, you know, in the prayer to my Heavenly Father says, you know, forgive my trespasses as I forgive those that trespass against me. And that's where the block is. It's like, oh my God, I cannot forgive, you know, it's
so sad. I've worked this program in AA. I have 8 years sober, and but with OA, I reset my abstinence again. And but I've been working it for a good 14 months. I've lost weight. I see the difference. I know I'm powerless over the cravings once I take the first bite. But this thing about blaming others, blaming the situation, it's, you know, and it's really hard. Yes?
Janelle, so good to hear your experience. Can you please form a question for Janet?
Oh, just how can I remove the block of that shame and guilt to let myself realize that, yes, my higher power can return me to sanity? I feel that block. What would you tell somebody that you're sponsoring, maybe, to work with that? Thank you.
What step are you on?
I'm actually on step 11, so it is hard for me to still connect and find a way to pray as well and feel,
okay.
I see it. Miracles happen in my life, but it's hard for me to feel the presence of my higher power and connect with him.
Okay, thank you for clarifying that. So based on what you said, I'd say a couple things. First, you know, as I said before, shame, feeling unworthy isn't an impediment, isn't a block from God, right? Because worthiness isn't a requirement. We think that it is. So I think it's just like telling ourselves like, oh, this isn't a requirement to get close to God as long as I'm willing. And you had mentioned blocks and being able to forgive. So I would say, I would encourage you to do like an uber 10th step of all your resentments and get with your sponsor or someone strong in recovery who can help you see your part if you don't see your part. Because I have found that in almost all my resentments, when I see my part, it dissolves the resentment. And I always have a part. The part may just be I have a demand for people to have my values, but I always have a part. And that dissolves most of them. And the ones that don't get dissolved, I pray the resentment prayer in the book, and that dissolves 100% of those. So that's what I would suggest to you at this time. Thanks.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Janelle. Nancy L., your turn.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks, Janet. Wow, that was amazing and very helpful. My question is a little bit to what you answered just now, and that is, I've been hurt by someone. I've done a 10-step over it. I've seen my part, et cetera, et cetera. But now I bump into that person at a meeting or at church or at the grocery store, and that all that old yucky feeling comes back. Would you say that maybe I'm just too sensitive? And if so, what can I do about that? Thank you.
I would suggest two things. I would suggest, and I'm sorry, I don't know what page it's on, but there's the resentment prayer in the book where it's like if you have a resentment against someone, you pray it for 2 weeks, asking that they get everything that you want for yourself. And so I would encourage you to do that. And then I would also encourage you to do something nice for this person, ideally anonymously, but do some active service for this person. So those are the two things I could think of. Thanks.
Thank you, Nancy L., for that question. Kathy K., your turn. Star one to unmute.
Good morning. Thank you, Leah, for your service. And thank you, Janet. It was great to hear you. What I want to ask you is, as someone who's been in these rooms for over 30 years, I find myself every few years getting stuck and not feeling spiritually connected. And to date, what I do when that happens, I change the meetings I go to. I start another big book study. I'm wondering if you have times like this, and if so, what you do to reconnect to your higher power.
So, I mean, there are times where I feel closer to God than others, but I would say the antidote is to keep active in 10, 11, and 12. So I am very rigorous with myself, not hard on myself, but rigorous on myself with looking at what I've done wrong during the day, and I admit it. So I do that. I keep an active life of prayer and meditation. I spend about an hour every morning in prayer and meditation. And if things feel a little stale, I'll find some new spiritual literature that excites me about God, or try a new way to pray and meditate. Then I think a main thing is I sponsor a good number of people. And I think if I'm starting to feel a little spiritually dull, then maybe I need to take on another sponsee. Because every time I talk to a new sponsee about this program and take her through the steps, it brings it alive to me again. So I think that is the key, is just working 10, 11, and 12 just really hard every day for the rest of our lives.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy K. We have time for a few more questions. If you have a question, star one to unmute. I need your name, including the first letter of your last name.
Elaine S. from New York.
Elaine.
Shana R.
Shana R. Anyone else?
Alexis F.
And Alexis F. Okay. Elaine F., go ahead and pose your question, please.
Thank you so much, Leah and Janet. Just such a powerful, powerful talk, and just what I need to hear. And my question is about something I know you've talked about in the past, which is the hospitalization period. How do you define the hospitalization period for someone who feels spiritually connected to God but continues to periodically relapse?
So, I mean, I don't really use that term hospitalization period a lot. What I tell my sponsees is when they start, they should kind of treat it as if they're in outpatient rehab so that they that they don't take up a new hobby that takes up a lot of time, that they really, they obviously they go to work, they take care of their family, their health, their hygiene, that stuff. But the bulk of their spare time should be set aside for recovery work. And I give them the numbers of like a lot of recovered people so that they get involved in fellowship. That being said, with someone who keeps relapsing, I would focus on why that person keeps relapsing. So I did a talk on Vision, the pitfalls in recovery, which talks about, I went through the big book to see all the things that cause a person to relapse. So I would have her identify why she relapsed, why she keeps relapsing, what's the cause, and go from there.
Thank you, Elaine,
Thank
for
you
your question.
So much.
Shana R., your turn. Shana R., star one to unmute.
Hi, thank you so very much, Janet, for this just wonderful share. I have always been a little bit, dubious about the blanket statement that deep down within every woman is the idea of God. When I see so much evil, I find it hard to reconcile generally evil and bad people, and I've been a victim of quite a few crimes, with the idea that those people don't seem to have the idea of God within them. So that's my question. How do I reconcile, you know, that statement with what I see, which is a lot of bad people? So that's my question. Thank you so much.
Yeah, so it says the fundamental idea of God is in everyone, but it can be obscured, blocked by calamity, pomp, or worship of other things. And so for some people, the idea may be so obscured by calamity, pomp, or worship of other things, but it's hard to see, but it's there. And I think realizing that it's there, even in people that are doing bad things, it helps us. Like, it just helps us, I don't know, be more compassionate. But it is there in everyone. It just may be more obscured in some people than in others.
Thank you, Shana R. Our final question for the morning comes from Alexis F.
Good morning, Leah. Good morning, Janet. Thank you for your service. My question is, if you say, you're the second person that I've heard to say the second step is so important when it comes to the belief that God can do anything for you. And God spoke to me when I gave up smoking, and he said, you will. And I said, I can't, God. I know I can't do this. And he said, you will. And I said, I can't do this, God, help me. And I never smoked another cigarette after smoking 4 to 5 packs a day. Everybody wanted the miracle that I had. My husband saw close to the curtain, and they almost burned the whole condominium section down. There were like 8 units of people that could not get out. They had walkers and wheelchairs. I couldn't do it. I couldn't hurt these people, so I quit. So,
Alexis,
my question.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah, 2 people have said that the second step is very important in your conception of God and the continuance of your program. I've heard that the importance of the second step. How do you relate that to sponsees?
Well, I think just that as I work through the steps with my sponsees, we do step 1 and then we do step 2 and then we do step 3, and each step builds on the other. So I just work them through in order.
Thank you,
okay.
Alexis. For
okay, thank you.
Thank you, Alexis, for your question. Thanks to all who posed questions. And, of course, thank you so much, Janet, for giving so much of yourself this morning, bringing to life step 2 for all of us in such outstanding fashion. The share ID for this morning, 23,135. That's 23,135. And we will now close the meeting for the morning from page 164 from a chapter entitled A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.